Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play dude.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, welcome to the toy department. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. What a week, man. What a couple weeks in the world. How you doing today?
Are we ever going to talk again and not be like, whew, what a week?
God, I hope so. I really do.
That's a future that I also hope is coming but can't really see.
Does it feel to you like at least it's a little bit more of a hopeful note this week than maybe the past few?
Yeah, maybe. What's interesting is the hope and the anger are intertwined in many ways, right? I mean, I think the hope in a lot of ways depends on maintaining anger. And I think the anger is of a righteous nature in that it believes there is hope. So it's a complicated thing, but yeah, I mean, I really do hope this is a pivotal time in history.
I was just watching SportsCenter, and they had a guy on who wrote that "Hell Yeah, It's Time We Took Down the Confederate Flag" in NASCAR story.
Ryan McGee.
Ryan McGee, yeah, you know the story I'm talking about. And I have to say, you know, I was surprised to hear him talk about the reaction to the piece. You know, because obviously there was a certain reaction that you would expect to that piece, and he got some of that, but he said it was overwhelmingly positive, which would not have expected. And something about that made me feel good. He kind of went on to say, like, you know, NASCAR had actually kind of been counting this out a little bit, and they'd found themselves counting the flags and noticing they'd been dwindling in numbers anyway. Mm-hmm. And I saw, you know, NASCAR get, you know, the kind of like dunk on that driver who was like, I'm quitting because of this.
Right.
And I'm not saying, you know, hey, everything's solved, but it just made me feel like it was just another one of those bricks of things of like, wow, like there are certain things that are really moving. It's not necessarily mm-hmm. the work that's going to solve this issue, but people are in a different place to handle this than they were before. And I guess that's maybe the hope that I have right now.
I saw the polls today where a majority of people in this country allegedly now, you know, are on the side of Black Lives Matter. And also the majority of respondents to a Yahoo Sports poll said, go ahead and kneel.
Yeah. So
that feels like a change to me. And look, I think we have to also be realistic in that all of these corporations from the NFL down to, you know, with the possible exception of Ben and Jerry's from the NFL.
Yeah, because Ben and Jerry's is down.
They're down for real. They're for real down. And they always have been. Like, you shouldn't be surprised. That's who they've always been.
It's true.
But everybody else, you know, all the statements, empty or not, are a sign more than anything that it has become a good business decision to align yourselves with Black Lives Matter. And I think, as frustrating as it is that that's what it takes, the fact that that has happened is a very good sign, because it really does mean numbers are on your side.
Because that's the way it should be. Like, for everyone who's been saying it all along and being like, why is this even a debate? You know what I mean? It's
right.
Not. And you know, like, the world is coming to that reality. And it doesn't mean that everything is like, hey, everything's better, racism solved, you know?
Far from it.
But it at least it's, you know, reflective, and you don't necessarily – it's one less thing you feel like you're being gaslit about. You know what I mean?
Well, and it's one less pointless argument. Right. It's one less waste of time before we actually get to the work of accomplishing something, which is what American politics loves more than anything is the gas baggery that comes before you actually do anything.
Indeed. Well, we're going to have a couple days of hope, and then it's going to be we're going to be back to the virus again, right?
So maybe, man, because the rates are spiking everywhere, and yeah. I have a feeling those protests didn't help. So,
Indeed. Yep.
Let's have some fun with pop culture.
Let's have some fun while we still get. And before it runs out, right? Like, we haven't really talked about that, right? Ultimately, there's a little bit of a content cliff. You know what I mean? That is clearly going to happen. So
I was saying this to somebody that on the radio when we were talking about sports coming back and like, oh, you know, they're taking so long that by the time they come back, someone was saying this, by the time they come back, you know, like there's going to be so much other stuff going on. People are going to be back to work. They're like missing the opportunity. And I was like, I think sports are coming back just as the content dies.
Yeah.
Because we're about to see the effects of nobody being at work in the entertainment industry since March. So no movies, no new TV shows, everything that was, you know, all the big movies have already been delayed a year. Like, we're going to have nothing new coming out. By the way, subscribe to our podcast, The Toy Department, where we talk about exciting new things in pop culture on a weekly basis.
we'll be fully in rewatchables mode at that point.
Look, man, I mean, we're going to figure it out, and hopefully, you know, technically we get into sports sometimes, so we'll do some of that too, but it's going to be very interesting to see what content looks like in the fall.
Yeah, I can tell you there is some music that got held up because the you know everything is sort of bundled into touring plans and then those touring plans collapse. So you know maybe some of that I'll see the light of day. You know, who knows?
You got anything specific in mind when you say that?
No, just I would say a general industry practice. I knew of a few records that kind of got shelved. So
okay, all right. Okay.
Yeah, you know.
Very
so
coy.
We'll see.
You're being very coy. I feel like you know something that you're not sharing, but fair enough.
It's not that. It's like, I mean, I could throw out a few bands, but I don't know if any of the how much that would get you excited or not. So
okay.
And all I would say it's an industry-wide practice, so I think you'll see a few things is what I would say.
Take your word for it.
All right, let's jump into shows. You ready?
You know I am.
You want to start where we just watched with Top Chef?
Yeah, let's do that. So sad day for you, huh?
Yeah, I'm not necessarily gonna defend Kevin because he made a lot of mistakes, and you know, I think when they went dish for dish, Voltaggio's were generally better.
I think it was clear when they walked through it, you know, and sometimes they walk through it and then they go, I think we have our decision. And you're like, not from anything you just said just there.
well, and I thought like when they went to commercial before judges break, I was like, oh, Kevin's going home. That's exactly
what I said to the wife. And she was like, really? I think maybe Brian. And I was like, no, I'm telling you, Kevin's out of here.
But can I throw my butt out there?
Please.
To all of that.
I mean, go for it. Anytime.
Look, I think at the end of the day, when you are in Italy in a challenge and you're cooking for Italian chefs, and those Italian chefs say multiple times with both courses that you didn't cook with any heart, and when Tom says, I don't know that you made food that is, you know, good enough to get into the final, like that might be enough to sort of overcome the mistakes that Kevin made. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying like he was robbed, but you could see. I mean, this is one thing that's interesting because I think there's definitely been an idea this season that these are all stars, and a lot of them are pretty established career wise.
Yeah.
Outside of this place, some of them like Malarkey are independently wealthy. By the way, we kind of glossed over last week the private jet joke that Kevin dropped on that plane about Malarkey, where everybody laughed. about Malarkey Airlines. Like, that's how rich Malarkey is. But there's been this idea that a lot of these chefs didn't want to win and or didn't weren't that invested in winning. Like, everybody wanted to win, but yeah, whatever, we're good, right? And I think that you saw on Kevin and Brian Voltaggio's face with the criticism that they got and just how stung by it they were, yeah. Voltaggio in particular, that these guys really cared.
Oh, I thought they both were insulted enough to get a little mouthy about it.
Yeah.
Like, it was an emotional...
You got a mount of defense when someone says you don't cook with heart, right?
Yeah, but he, like, raised his voice a little, you know? Like, yeah. He was spicy about it, which...
He was fighting back tears, I thought.
Yeah. I mean, look, understandable. On the other hand, I didn't even taste it, and I know exactly what they mean.
It's a little bit true. And even Kevin, when they said the no heart thing, even Kevin kind of went, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a tough thing to say.
Yeah.
Especially to an Italian guy in Italy.
It's true. But those guys said it. And I think Padma was right to pass it on. I think she also really knew, you know, that those words were going to sting.
Oh, she knew what she was doing as a television host there for sure. But
yeah.
At the same time, I agree with
you. And fluent Italian speaker.
Yeah. But you know what? I think that has the chance to serve him in the final, because what the one particularly curmudgeonly Italian chef who hated everything, by the way, which was hilarious. There was one dude there who was like, "This is bad." Also, I do not like this. but what they mean is the same thing we've seen from Voltaggio all season, which is like sometimes he gets so wrapped up in doing insane technical stuff that like you lose the thread basically. Yeah. Right? That's how.
Yeah, I agree that. I mean, I think that's been the Voltaggio criticism this year, and he is a guy that can gear up the artistry when he wants. But you're right, the technical proficiency often overshadows it, and he is not always a risk taker.
Yeah.
And when he isn't, he seems to fall flat. So you're right. I think that might really push him, you know, in this final to go balls for the wall. And I got to say, as we get to this final, you know, you look, Melissa has been the favorite, for a while and deservedly so. But I think there are three people capable of winning this final.
Oh, no doubt. And Stephanie is on a roll, man.
Yeah. It's hard for me to put her in the class of chef.
No,
overall,
look, her role is still finishing second to Melissa, but she's hot right now. She is.
Right. No, the form that she's on, and it's kind of an extended run. Like, you know, she's got a real puncher's chance to win this thing. You know, I thought for sure when she, you know, made just kind of basically a prosciutto ragu, threw some Parmesan cheese on it.
Yeah.
That she was going to get crushed. And when was the last time you saw Padma go, before the chef?
I was going to bring that up. She literally, I've never seen that. She made like a yummy noise. Like in the middle of the chef talking.
Yeah.
You never see that.
Yeah. I was like, wow. Yeah. It was that. And when Kevin was at the prosciutto place, I really thought he wanted to make out.
Well, they turned on porn music. That was an excellent moment for the producers because he was like making funny faces and closing his eyes. And then all of a sudden the music is like, boom. Bow.
Yeah.
You're like, oh god. And then was it Melissa was like, tasting the prosciutto was a special time for Kevin.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna bring something up. I am looking at the stats of the top of the chef right now. And the degree to which Melissa is dominating this season is hard to overstate. She lost Restaurant Wars. And yet, in 13 episodes, she has won 6 elimination challenges and 3 quickfire challenges.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's absurd.
She is crushing it, and there is an artistry to what she's doing on every level. And it's one thing that, like, it wasn't even really commented upon on her dish. The presentation of the secondi by Melissa was incredible. Like, it was like art with the way that she had sort of arranged the vegetables on that plate and like right around that scallop with the sauce.
Yep.
And you know, obviously getting these flavors, and there's a creativity, and she's clearly thought so much about how she would merge what she did with local tradition, and it's been a success every freaking time out. And yeah, like I said, she's deservedly the favorite. She has clearly been the best chef overall. And a lot of the chefs who you would say were kind of in her league, and certainly really the only other chefs to win multiple challenges, I think, right, are gone. So, she's definitely had the pedigree.
Gregory and Kevin were the only other chefs. Oh, no. Well, Stephanie, actually, because she won Restaurant Wars, if you count that.
Right. Oh, if you count Restaurant Wars. Okay. But she only won one solo challenge, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So.
She did win one quickfire.
And a quickfire, right. Yep. But I, you know what I mean? Like, it's clearly, it's, you know.
No, she.
It's Melissa and then everybody else in terms of performance.
I mean,
no
listen.
Doubt.
Brian Voltaggio has been pretty solid, and although he only has one elimination challenge win, he did finish in like the top, whatever, you know, like the top portion 4 other times. So, you know, he's been hanging around. We've been talking about this all season, and clearly he has the ability. I mean, look, we go freestyle now, right? It's a 4-course meal. And did you watch the scenes from next week?
I did, yes.
So you saw Leanne's trying to mess up Melissa's like, perfect season. You saw that. So I'm just saying, if Leanne comes back and ruins it for Melissa, it's going to be a big pile of I told you so next week.
I'm pretty sure you pick your sous chefs, and you also don't have to listen to them.
Stank ass, Leanne.
That's funny. Have you heard there is like a trailer theory going around? You know, it wasn't in this one. It was a trailer from earlier in the season, but they had the clip of Padma saying, "You are Top Chef." And there was a certain excitement in her voice that led a lot of people to believe that it will be Stephanie.
Really?
Just based on the tone. You know
why would
I mean?
The tone not be excited for Melissa?
Because
too obvious.
I think, yeah, exactly. It was the tone indicated that it was someone unexpected. You know what I mean?
That's
whereas
very
Melissa
deep,
would be
man.
The expected. You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying I subscribe to this theory. I've just heard it going around the internet.
Okay,
so that's all I'm saying.
Well, all listen, right. I'll tell you what. I'm torn because I like Stephanie, man, and I like an underdog story, and she's cooking great right now. I mean, the fact that that weird cabbage prosciutto lasagna worked, that seemed to be most people's favorite dish. And that after, dude, the one thing they told them at the prosciutto di Parma factory
was don't cook it.
Was
yeah.
Don't cook this shit, man. Whatever you do, don't cook it. The last thing you want to do is cook it. And the first thing she did was cook it. And they were like, that was delicious.
Yep.
So props to her. I would not be upset if she won. Although, I do feel like it'd be a little bit like the Warriors going, you know, 73-9 and then not winning the title for Melissa.
Yeah. Like, if you had come to me when she's like plating this braised cabbage and said to me, one of these Michelin starred Italian chefs is going to say this is like a lasagna.
Right.
And love it.
Love it.
I would have given you like 20-1 odds.
Oh, man. She's rolling. She's just feeling herself. Yeah. And she knows what she wants to do and she's hitting it, which is what Melissa has done most of the season.
Yeah. And look, for me, I think it would be more feel. I always enjoy Stephanie. It's like it'd be feel bad. But I feel like I think I would have felt at another point like, okay, like kind of like when Hosea won all those years back. Do you remember that? Do you remember that season?
Where I don't think, like, I saw that season.
It was an early one where it was like a guy, like he was a likable guy and, you know, he earned the win in the final, but he was clearly not the best chef all year. One of those sort of deals. You know what I mean? And I think that's where I would have been, where it was like, oh, all right, well, you know, hey, yay for you, but now I think she's cooked well enough that, like, it's just an underdog story at this point.
Right.
So, you know, good for her.
Props to Stephanie. She really came into her own down the stretch. And look, man, we keep saying it. Brian Voltaggio is dangerous. So this is going to be a great final.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. And I think I think the format, again, is going to be I don't know if it's advantage the right word, but I think we'll get to the challenge in a second, but it's like when you get that elimination that feels suited to your strengths.
Yeah.
I think sort of the freestyle challenge is going to be a nice palette for Brian to up that sort of creativity level.
Agreed.
Agreed, should be
man,
a fun one.
Melissa's been so good. It's hard. It's not that either of the other two can't win. It's that it's hard for me to imagine Melissa not cooking a 4-course meal that is beautiful and spectacular.
Yeah, she's clearly the odds-on favorite.
Yeah.
Do you? So you and Melissa live in the same city. Have you ever eaten her food? Does she have a restaurant?
Well, except
like a private chef, right?
As I told you last week, I've eaten her ice cream from Humphrey Slocum. My understanding is she is like a consultant and does some private chefing, and I don't know. I looked at her website, but it does not seem like she's at a restaurant at the moment.
It seems odd because I feel like, and certainly after the show, it seems like she could make a lot of money.
Yeah, so. Well, I do wonder if this show, when she wins $250,000, except now, I mean, who knows, you know? What if she was about to start a restaurant?
Yeah, obviously, March? It's a strange time to open up a restaurant.
I don't know what, yeah. I mean, I think private chefs are probably doing better than restaurants by a lot right now, so.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. We shall see, but I would love to have the chance to taste her food someday because, man, it looks good on TV.
Oh, man, it looks good. I'm right there with you. I'd love to eat it, so fingers crossed.
All right, let's jump into the challenge. Much in the way that real life sort of intervened in the start of this podcast, it intervened in the challenge this week as well.
Oh, I thought you were going to go ahead and explain that.
Yeah, I was just waiting for a beat.
Yeah, it's yeah.
Okay, so here's the deal. On social media posted some insensitive comments about Black Lives Matter.
Can we talk about the comments for a second? Because
we can.
I think you used the right word. They were insensitive. I didn't think they were inflammatory or antagonistic or evidence of like a black soul or a despicable racist or anything. I thought they were tone deaf and insensitive and like kind of ditzy. But I was
surprised. I would agree with that characterization, but apparently there was also... And now I'm going to get the facts of this wrong. I don't know if she went on an Insta, she made some comments on an Instagram post that I think was about George Floyd, hopefully not actually George Floyd's account or something, but it was basically to the effect of people die every day.
Yeah, well, that's worse.
Yeah, so you know, when I saw that, I kind of moved me out of that camp of just kind of into the camp that's problematic.
I'll say
so. Bottom line, we're, yes, go ahead.
I do think it's probably fair to say that she is guilty mostly of stupidity.
Mostly, yes, but a lot of black cast members on this season had clapped back at her and were not real happy. And
well, and they gave the impression, at least Bailey did, that like this was no surprise, sort of a thing.
Yeah,
which leads me to believe that Dee's reputation in general is not great, but maybe even specifically as it regards racism.
Yeah, so I don't, you know, and I don't know about that. Generally, when anything vaguely racist happens in the show, they, you know, they jump on that as content, right?
Yeah, but there's a difference between something racist happening and like the black people in the house being like, yeah. Could have seen this coming. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
Like, it's like, they know. Like, the people in the house know if D is a little bit racist. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and especially when it's Big T.
Yeah.
Who is, you know what I mean?
Doesn't seem like the type to overreact to that sort of thing.
Agreed. And it's just like sweetness and beloved,
right,
by all.
Exactly.
So
it's not a good look for D.
Not a good look for D. So bottom line, regardless of what we thought about it, I didn't get to this part. MTV has cut ties with D.
Bye-bye. And, you know, good riddance. And frankly, like, I don't want to suggest anything other than this, which is what I believe, which is if this is a sign of the line you ought not step over when it comes to racism moving considerably, good.
Yeah. I'm not going to question the wisdom of the decision. But it's left a sort of an issue in that, you know, she's not going to participate in the union or whatever, but she's still on the show.
Yeah.
And they have sort of committed to showing the, you know, the rest of the show, as I think they should.
And so, she right now is on a pretty clear-cut path for the final, and I mean, we'll see what happens when we get there, but like, she's pretty much going, because I don't see why anyone would throw her in again,
right? And the point is that I think that this is what, you know, is notable in that I feel like you can really see the effect of MTV not quite knowing what to do with her in the edit room.
Yep.
On this episode, right? We got an hour episode instead of a half hour one, and when you think about how much of the politics in this game really revolved around D,
yep,
there was actually very little of her, and we didn't get any of, even though, you know, Johnny Rogan did an incredible straight out of WWE, like Hulk Hogan, Paul, Mr. Wonderful Orndorff heel turn on her. Like, we never got any of that lead up that you usually get in those situations where she's going to give you background on how she's feeling about things with her and Rogan and Johnny and where she's in the game.
Not
we didn't
only
get much
that,
of, none of that stuff that you would normally get, right?
Not just that, there was no post betrayal ITM from D.
Yeah. And not even any of the, right, exactly, that you guys, or any of that, like her talking shit to the, you guys thought you'd get rid of me on,
right?
You know what I mean? Like,
there was no, I can't believe you, these guys turned on me, like, I'm coming back for them. None of that stuff.
Yeah, like, they just completely minimized her. And as you said, I don't know that can be a workable strategy going forward, because she sure does seem ticket to the finals. Now, obviously, they know some things that we don't, but it just seems pretty unlikely that anyone's going to toss her in again.
Well, what would you have done?
It seemed pretty unlikely they tossed her in the first place.
I can't believe they did it. I honestly can't believe it. It was such an incredible move by Johnny Bananas, too, to make Rogan do it.
Yeah, you know,
to be like, I'll do this, but I'm not going down alone. Because he knows if Dee comes back in the house pissed, she's going after Rogan first.
Right, correct. Correct. Yeah, the house game by Johnny has been, you know, it's like a LeBron at age 37.
It really
know,
is.
Sort of performance
it's,
from him.
It's pretty flawless, man.
You know, a little craftier, you know, maybe doesn't quite have the athletic pop anymore, but has
wielding
been manipulating
big influence.
These guys.
Wielding yep, big yep. influence, and when he did need to show up athletically, he did.
Sure did. And you know what? I think, honestly, like, in retrospect, the alliance with Wes was a smart play for both of those guys who had had a couple of early exits.
Yep.
They really did give each other strength, and they should always remember that the later the game goes on, the better the two of their mental abilities are going to continue to serve them.
Yep.
And yeah, and I think, you know, I think you may be seeing Johnny as a finals contender for a few more years. I feel like this might prolong the life of him a little bit because, you know, in past seasons, he's just been an early target.
Yeah. Well, I think he and Wes represent so much bigger a target with so many more attachments that it's a lot harder to go after them early, which is really, like you said, their problem is the legend of both of them got so big that it became a badge of honor to eliminate them in the first three episodes.
Right. And they were also trying to take shots at each other at the time, right?
Yes,
so they would
were,
be among the people trying to get themselves right. eliminated.
Exactly. Yes. So it, I think they both probably realized, and I think that's why even after being forced to face each other somewhat, they were pretty cool about it, is like they both realized how many just like episodes they weren't on simply because they were at each other's throats all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I don't know about extra titles, but like clearly they both could have been on 20 more episodes of the show in the seasons where they got eliminated early.
Indeed. Indeed. And collecting those sweet, sweet appearance fees.
Exactly.
Other than that, a fairly mediocre episode, I thought, on the whole.
Relatively uneventful, other than, you know, what should have been the big story of the whole thing, which was the turn on Dee by Rogan. And we really didn't get the full complement of that, sadly. I have to say, Maddie got screwed. I mean, it's not quite as bad as giving Jordan pole wrestle with one hand, but it's in that zone. Because what else is she not beating Dee at, other than something where it literally is a horrible disadvantage to be huge?
Yeah, although, you know, that is something that Bananas and Rogan could have been able to infer.
You know what they should have done? You know what they actually should have done?
Throw anyone else in? I don't know.
Nani. Nani would have won that. That was Nani's chance.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
And but I don't think anyone imagined the challenge to be what it was upon looking at it. I think they thought there was going to be some sort of hauling of the dirt or shoveling of the dirt. You know what I'm saying? Because the things were open when they walked into Purgatory. So this apparatus that looks like it's just two huge piles of dirt in like a dumpster type thing, all of a sudden the top closes and it's a tunnel digging contest, and the like 6 foot, you know, 220-pound behemoth lady is in big trouble.
Yeah. You got to say, for Dee, you know, you don't think of her as an athlete, but we've seen her a couple
good,
of times now. She's been able to summon it when she's needed it.
She really has. Like, you just, even this, it wasn't that impressive specifically, but you just have to respect the totality of accomplishment at a certain point, right?
Yeah.
Even if no one step of the way ever feels like Dee is one of the better players, but at a certain point, you keep putting up W's. I don't know how we can keep doubting.
Right. I think it just becomes what it is at that point. You know, there's a reason certain players win a bunch, and there's a reason certain players never win. You know what I mean? And you know, ball don't lie at the exactly. at the end of these things.
Yeah.
so.
But I look, I'd be thrilled if, you know, somehow, I don't even know how it would be. Because right now, Bailey, Nani, and Melissa all need a red skull. So all three of them are going to want to go in next time it's a girl's elimination. You know what I was kind of thinking might happen here? Is next week will be guys, week after girls, and then maybe we get one more double elimination before the finals.
Maybe. I think it might be one each, to be honest.
Because if it's one of each, there's people who are just going to be in that,
yeah.
Whoops, didn't get my skull. Guess I'm not going to the final. Good night.
Yeah. I think they're going to push that button at some point, right?
Maybe. So that means next week it's going to be Bailey, Nani, and Melissa all fighting to be thrown in.
Yeah. The problem is everybody's figured out that they don't necessarily have to compete that hard on the challenges, right? Like, they can just kind of lose and then ask to be sent in.
Well, but not next week. Because really what you're going to have is probably two girls fighting. I mean, if one of them gets in the tribunal, then they're in.
The fighting only happens if they know that that's the last elimination.
No, I don't think so. At this point, they're going to have to believe it's getting close if it's not last. Like, everyone is going to want to go in now. And I think, like, next week for the guys, what is it? So it's Kyle, Josh. Who else doesn't have – Swaggy.
Yeah. God, it feels like there's more on the guys' side.
That might be it. It might be Kyle, Josh, and Swaggy. Who don't have skulls. Is that it? Because Fessy
and Bananas and Rogan have them.
And Corey and Nelson both do, right? Or does Corey not? Corey doesn't.
I don't think Corey does. No, because Corey has to go in if last time.
So
if
that's
I'm
four. So it's Corey, yeah. Kyle. I already forgot. But there's four guys. So if this is the last guy's elimination, you know, there's potentially two guys left just on the outside in the cold.
Yeah, could be. But I do think they're going to leave somebody in the cold because I think they almost have to do it to make the mechanics of the game work, right? So
yeah,
we'll see. Here's what's interesting:
if you're in the tribunal and you have your red skull. Don't you send somebody else with a red skull in?
Just to keep more people out?
Less competition in the final.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you do. If you're smart enough to think of this.
So these next 2 weeks, it's going to be super important for people without red skulls to win challenges.
Yeah.
Get in that tribunal. Put yourself in.
It doesn't seem like a lot of the people left, Swaggy being the one exception I can think of, who don't have skulls, have won a lot of challenges.
Josh hasn't won much. Swaggy
Corey
has won a little.
Corey and Kyle haven't won shit.
Corey and Kyle. Yeah. Kyle really has played the perfect game for a normal challenge season.
Yeah, it's completely under the radar.
He's just cruising to the final, except he can't.
Yeah, it's true. And I don't. He doesn't seem all that anxious to try to get in.
It's the weirdest thing.
You notice that?
He seems totally comfortable. And that's why I do wonder, like, maybe he's just chill with the appearance fees, and he's like, I don't really want to do one of those crazy-ass finals again anyway. Because I gotta tell you, like, Anissa, I'm seriously worried about Anissa, man.
Yeah, she might die.
and honestly, Fessy is gonna be interesting to watch for the final. because he's perfect for everything else. He's just a behemoth. But the one thing we haven't seen tested is his endurance. And that's usually the biggest part of the final.
We know a final will do that. And I feel like a final in Prague, for whatever reason, is going to be like just grueling.
Gulag-y.
Just something about this season and the darkness.
Do we know
and
they're
the
in Prague? Is that confirmed?
I'm pretty sure they're in Prague. I believe I've read that.
This is one of the least, like, usually they're all about, like, here we are in South Africa. And here, this season is all about, like, you're in a bunker.
Yep. And then you pop up and you're in a field.
Right. With tanks. More tanks next week.
But they have to go somewhere where there's a bar, right? And I think that's Prague.
Okay. Yeah. No, I mean, obviously they're apparently somewhere. Underground bars feels very Prague to me.
So. Right, all the bars they've been in have been underground bars to this point.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. All right, should we move on to I May Destroy You?
Yeah.
I don't have a ton to say about this show.
It's really hard after 30 minutes of a show, but
yeah,
I would say this. Going in, pretty much, I had seen the preview and gathered that, like, it was going to be a show involving and kind of about rape. And maybe that will change the tone since, you know, the understanding of something happening doesn't occur till the end of the first episode. But this show is very lively. The show has a lot of, like, frenetic energy to it that doesn't feel negative. Like,
correct,
it's not bad time television at all.
Right. It was the first episode was very interesting. I just don't feel like I know what it's going to be yet.
Right. I agree. It was a very interesting episode. Michaela Cole has a quality. I don't know what. She's like just one of those people who draws you in on the screen. She's magnetic almost and just, like, fascinating. You want to know more about what's going on with that woman.
Yeah. Yeah, she has a presence. And the character is interesting. The fact she has on people seem to be interesting. And
yeah, well, and, like, we don't totally understand her place in the world, but we understand it's a public place. And like, she has a following, clearly, right?
Yeah.
So, like, there's a lot going on here. It's a complicated character. It's a complicated 30-minute pilot, and I'm definitely in for more.
I am too, but it's hard for me also to be like, you should absolutely watch this because like I said, I don't know what it's gonna be.
Well, right. I mean, again, so. it certainly seems like we're especially based on the end of the episode, mild spoiler, that we're about to dive deep into a rape story. That being said, yeah, I don't know what that means in this context. And I don't know. That's exciting. I would recommend it. You know, it's hard. You're right. We won't probably be able to say anything definitive for a while here, at least a few weeks. But like, it certainly has the beginnings and bones of a really interesting, good show.
Yeah. Oh, it's exciting. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's a you know, John Morant like, you know what I mean?
all the pieces are in place.
You're pretty sure it's gonna be good. We just need to let it play out.
That's fair. I think that makes a decent transition to my biggest disappointment of the week.
Oh, you carry on.
We don't know exactly what's going to go on here, but we're interested and excited, which describes how I felt before I started watching the ESPN documentary Be Water about Bruce Lee. And at the end of it, I was still fascinated by Bruce Lee, but I just didn't think the film was super interesting or well put together.
Yeah, there's something about it that leaves you at arm's length a little bit.
Yeah. And maybe that's just that there isn't enough stuff, but clearly to me, the best parts of this documentary were the, what, 5 minutes of footage of actual Bruce Lee talking, you know, maybe 10 minutes out of the hour and 40 or 2 hours, whatever it was. I wanted more of that. I would have rather watched one long form interview with Bruce Lee than this movie.
I could see that. I think the movie was hurt in a way by not having talking heads. I mean, they had talking heads, but like you don't until the end credits, you don't see them.
Yeah.
And
it felt more like a History Channel thing, right?
Yeah.
Like I learned a few facts, but like it didn't feel like it dug into the soul of this guy. And that's what was really interesting to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think hearing some of his poetry, I think it brought that soul in. And I think like an examination of what Bruce Lee meant as like a civil rights figure and a leading light for representation in the culture. Like some of that is there's a potentially interesting documentary in all of that.
Yes.
This just didn't totally.
Wasn't it?
Bring it all out for me. It didn't all click together. And while you would have liked more Bruce talking, like I think I would have liked more of Bruce, like I don't think I totally understood what made him a great martial artist. You know what I mean?
Or was he
other than
a great
he practiced
martial
a lot.
Artist? Or was
right.
he just
yeah,
a great
or you don't even
movie star.
Right.
That no, I agree. That's part of his story that I've always been fascinated by. I mean, it seems like he was also like a significant sensei in his own right.
Right.
But we didn't really. You're right. They did not explain that sufficiently, and they did not talk about his practice that specifically. And that's why I say it felt more like History Channel, you know, or like a PBS documentary.
That PBS, like, totally.
Covers some important facts, but doesn't totally come together. And I also thought it was, this is a minor complaint, but I thought it was organized oddly. Like the timeline was, there was no timeline.
It jumped around a lot.
In a way that didn't totally make sense to me. So, yeah, I was just, and I guess part of it was I also had very high expectations, you know? Bruce Lee to me is this sort of shadowy, fascinating figure that I don't know a ton about, and I was excited, and there was just sort of nothing exciting about the film itself.
Yeah, it seems like you shouldn't be able to make a documentary about such a fascinating figure that's not fascinating.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what we came up with. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
That said, the one of the things that did really jump out at me in a visceral way were, God, the ways that we used to portray Asians in movies.
Oh, man.
Whoa.
And it's really bad, man. I'll never forget the first time that hit me. Which was in college. I want to say it was my freshman year. And have you ever seen the movie Murder by Death?
I don't think I have, no.
It is essentially a 1970s version of like a Clue type of movie. A bunch of people in a mansion, people getting murdered sort of deal. Except it's, you know, the psychotic rich guy who organizes the whole thing is Truman Capote. And
okay.
His guests are five famous private eyes. Peter Falk playing a by a different name version of Columbo. Elsa Lanchester playing a goofy lady detective named Jessica Marbles, and Peter Sellers, the great Peter Sellers, playing a Japanese detective by the name of Sidney Wang. And here's the thing, man. The first time I saw a 1976 Six's Murder by Death. You know, it's written by Neil Simon. Like, it's really funny. And that's all I remembered. And one night in college with a group of friends, including my Korean pal, G, I was like, oh man, we should watch this movie, Murder by Death. It's hilarious. And it was a very uncomfortable experience.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah, I can imagine.
And like, I was struck by two things. Number one, how over the top and offensive this portrayal by one of America's most treasured comic actors, who, you know, was also, I think, generally considered a heck of a nice guy. How offensive it was. And then secondly, how little that had occurred to me when I wasn't sitting in the room with my friend who happened to be Asian.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, every once in a while you get these sort of controversies. Like, I feel like Emma Stone was maybe the last one. There was Emma Stone was playing an Asian character in a movie and people got upset about it and she dropped out. Maybe she didn't drop out. I don't remember, actually.
I don't remember that controversy. But obviously,
it was a Cameron Crowe movie, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, I know there was the Scarlett Johansson thing with Ghost in the Shell. Like, there obviously appropriation of this kind continues in ways that are not acceptable. But this is a different level, and really,
oh, sure,
that like sort of hideous level of Asian American caricature certainly persisted through our childhoods. You know,
absolutely.
Like, that's not a relic of the ancient past.
My point about that is not to say like that it's yes, it was way worse then. But the thing that I sort of realize as I'm watching like John Wayne play Genghis Khan.
Right.
You know, in the same way that people go now like, oh, you're overreacting, like it's acting. Can a person, you know, like an Australian person can play American? Why can't I, you know, blah, all those things that you hear.
Yeah.
And you realize like, back then, they thought, sure, we can just have John Wayne play an Asian person. It'll be fine. You know what I mean?
Right.
In the same way we think that now, and we don't understand that experience, and we don't give people it just sort of all laid out there to me when you realize, like, oh, well, this is why we should try to do this way.
This is why it's so important when real representation happens.
Yeah, because otherwise you don't know. You know what I mean?
And I think that was the coolest part of this documentary was Bruce Lee understanding at a time when it wasn't something that was talked about, understanding the importance of representation. The most interesting and impressive thing that I learned about Bruce Lee from watching this was that he was turning down roles because they were not fair or what he felt to be. He felt they were too stereotypical portrayals of Asian characters. And that's a heck of a stand to take at that time. Because remember, he really wasn't an American movie star until he was, like, dying.
Yeah.
So when he's turning down, like, what could potentially be his big break when he's saying, no thanks, I don't want to play characters that don't reflect positively upon my community. That made it a timely story in that, you know, he was a great leader and representative of his minority community.
Yeah. Also, what a life Kareem led. You know?
Such an interesting guy.
At like
such an interesting
any number
guy.
Of turns. On into today.
Well, what's cool about someone like Kareem is like, look, you're not going to have a lot of guys, as they say, God doesn't give with both hands. You know, you're not going to have a lot of guys that good at sports who are also that thoughtful and intelligent, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't happen that much. But what's really cool about it when it does happen is because you're that good at sports, you're running in the sort of circles that you can get in touch with anybody in the world that you want to, which means if you're a thinker and like a searcher, you can be in touch with the most impressive and interesting people in every field on the planet, right?
Yeah.
So if you're someone like Kareem, you get to know Malcolm X and Bruce Lee and, you know what I'm saying? Like, it just, whoever you want at the top of their
game
in everything.
But he was, 19, 20 when he, you know, right? Because he met Bruce Lee when he was at UCLA.
Yeah.
So
no, I mean Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Just to have the,
he's one of the most impressive people ever to live on the planet Earth.
Yeah, it's quite something. Quite something.
He really is. Like, he might be a curmudgeon or whatever. He has some things, you know. He doesn't have the best reputation as like a nice guy, but man, is he interesting and smart and thoughtful and learned and what a life.
Yeah, I was in the security line at LaGuardia with him once.
I gave
a head nod.
Nice, good job. I bet he remembers.
Yeah, thanks.
I was at a red carpet club with Bill Walton one time.
Did you get some stories out of Bill?
No, that was I was a kid then. I didn't know who he, my dad pointed a giant redhead out to me and said, "That's Bill Walton. Let me tell you about him in the red carpet club." Since then, I have met Bill Walton and interviewed Bill Walton and gotten plenty of stories out of him. He is a gem.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
The second time I saw him in the wild was backstage at a Grateful Dead show.
Of course.
I was part of the catering team, and he was Bill Walton.
Right. Probably didn't stop you guys from sharing a joint. Speaking of joints, RTJ4, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Fair to say the record of the moment? I think that's fair.
Yeah. It's I've listened to it a lot. I don't know about you. I had already listened to it two or three times by the time we assigned it for homework, and it was 48 hours old. So it's cool that the record of the moment was written months before the moment and feels so perfect. I mean, I think that is, first of all, it tells you like that this is not really, none of this is that fresh. This is a hot DJ remix of the same shit we've been dealing with for a while.
Right. A lot of this could be predicted.
Right.
A lot of it.
But this is also, I just think this is brilliant hip hop music for our times. It embraces the essence of what hip hop means in so many ways. I mean, the sort of punk roots of the genre, the speaking truth to power. It's also filled with clever rhymes and interesting insults and violent imagery. You know, like it is of its genre completely, but I also think it's elevated, it's smart, and I would say each successive Run the Jewels record has been a little more political than the last, and I think that trend continues here.
It reminds me of like a Beastie Boys record if the Beastie Boys were much more competent lyrically,
better rappers, right?
Right, that's what I mean. Better rappers, sharper observers of politics as well.
Yes, sharper lyricists and observers, and better rappers. Yeah, but it has the man. What LP is doing as a producer, I just think is so awesome and incredible right now, because a lot his roots are really in like this industrial sound, you know, and. Something about working with Killer Mike and producing beats for this group has melded that like hardcore industrial sound into like sort of half, you know, Nine Inch Nails industrial sound, but half like boom bap, you know, old school hip hop sound. And I just, man, it speaks directly to my soul, directly to the like music center in the insides of me. I can't get enough of this stuff. I love I worship their entire catalog, as a man once said about Michael Bolton. So I'm sort of in the bag here, but I just think two of the most interesting and admirable figures in the genre and two of the best rappers going right now, and just a tremendous album.
Yeah. And way to bring Zach De La Roca out of mothballs.
Well, that's sort of a tradition of theirs, too, is throw Zach De La Roca on a track once in a while. They've done it a few times now, I think. And he's the same. He's so good at what he does. I mean, it's a very specific thing.
he fits what they do. It fits with what they do very well too. Yep. I think, you know what I mean?
Yep. And again, the moment, you know.
Yeah.
Could use some Zach sure De La Rocas at the moment.
Good. You see, I'm assuming you saw the tweet that went around.
I did with the radio guy yelling at Tom Morello.
No.
Oh, with, the tweet. The Tom Morello tweet. What do you think they were raging against?
Political opinions. Right.
What machine did you think they were raging against? Oh man,
that tweet is amazing. Well, my other favorite part of that tweet is that the other person he's mad at is Pink.
I know. You and Pink are dead to me was basically the content of the tweet. But that's just, I mean, isn't that everything right there? Doesn't that just tell the whole story of our times? Is like, we're stuck here arguing with stupid people because there's so many of them, and some point in the last 20 years, somebody convinced them the best thing to do while stupid is proclaim it loudly and ignore intelligent people rather than shut up and listen. And I don't know why that happened or how, but it's a damn shame, and it's sort of ruining our country.
I think I told you the story. I witnessed this at when I went to the bathroom at a Roger Waters show.
Oh boy, this is a dangerous setting for a story. But go ahead.
But like, well, you know, the last tour was pretty, you know, pretty. I don't know, blatantly is the word, but obviously anti-Trump.
Yeah.
There was the giant Trump pig that flew around at one point. And I go to the bathroom and I'm getting these three guys like, I didn't come here for politics, came here for music. And I'm like, the man made a record called The Wall. Like, what did you think you were getting? But I can at least, it's at least sort of plausible to me that you could listen to Pink Floyd's music and not understand all the political implications. I think it's somewhat unlikely and it doesn't speak well for you, but it's at least plausible. How can you listen to 7 Rage Against the Machine songs, never mind like an album's worth, and like completely miss the politics? It's like it's all there is.
Literally, politics. How can you read the name of the band? Like, that's literally the point at which you should realize this is a political band and an anti-establishment political band at that. So, that's incredible. Amazing. And it's an incredible epic of stupidity, and I don't know what you could do to solve that. Because if someone literally can't understand that Rage Against the Machine is raging against the machine, what are we doing?
Yeah.
what on earth are we doing?
It's just like, I like to break microwaves. Sounds good to me.
Oh, man.
Maybe break some of that 5G towers that are killing everybody.
Oh, God.
Sorry, got too real now.
Make sure you drink your bleach before you go out and do all that. All right. I think on that note, it's time for homework.
Time for homework. All right. Top Chef and the Challenge. Man, this is it, right, for Top Chef, too, as well, right?
Top,
this is the last one.
Yes. Yeah, the season finale of Top Chef.
What a season it's been. And the Challenge rolls on as well. And then we're going to watch the latest 30 for 30. I think this is the last kind of in this run, called Long Gone Summer, which is about Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa.
Yeah. I have one moderately distressing thing to tell you that I heard about this.
Okay.
And we're going to watch it, but I was told by a source that the word steroids does not come up until the last 10 minutes of this film.
Really?
And if that is true, it's hard for me to understand how this exists, much less is any good. So you know, caveat emptor, but we are gonna watch it.
Yeah, it seems like a weird place to employ it, but whatever, we'll watch it. There's a new Spike Lee movie coming to Netflix called Defy Bloods.
Yes.
Some good buzz on that. It's a war movie, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Vietnam involved, yeah. But I think it's I think it's veterans going back in some way.
Gotcha. Okay. So yeah, we'll check that out. And then the new Pete Davidson Judd Apatow joint, talking about things that are in our wheelhouse. It's King of Staten Island.
Yeah.
So, and then that one is on demand. So, if you want to watch that one with us, it'll cost you some bucks. You know,
but you like, know, don't you miss like new movies?
I do miss new movies. Maybe some of you live somewhere where theaters are open. That those are starting to happen now. California's going to open some pretty soon from what I read. So.
Yeah, I think it's possible, in fact, that theaters near me will be open in time for me to see this if it were there. But I don't know. I think I'll stay home and keep myself safe if it's all the same to everybody.
I think that's the wise move, yeah. So King of Staten Island, loosely based on Pete's own life. So
sounds like fun.
Yeah, I'm excited. Excited for next week.
Yeah, two new movies. Look at that. Spike Lee, Judd Apatow. This is a big week. It's going to be great. Yeah.
Thank God I got nothing else to do.
Okay, have fun. Bye.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.